I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
Hey, welcome to Bird Calls, everybody. This is Chris Bozak, your host. Thanks for joining us on this beautiful Sunday afternoon. Thanks for taking a little break from your birding to tune in. We got a great show coming up, as always. Katie Fallon will be joining with us. She wrote the book Cerulean Blues, based on the plight of the cerulean warbler, which is a tiny little beautiful blue warbler. The cerulean warbler. And let's get this out of the way. Let's just see what the cerulean warbler sounds like. It's very warbler-like in its song. So a lot of warblers kind of sound similar, but that was a cerulean warbler. I like to play a bird call once a week, since this is called Bird Calls Radio. But it's a great book and a great topic that Katie has tackled in her first book, I believe it was. We'll get more from Katie a little bit, so excited to be talking to her. Migration is still upon us, maybe peaking now, maybe peaked a little bit couple days ago, maybe a week ago, but still lots of warblers and songbirds and different things out there. So lots to see and lots to talk about. And I'm going to let the listeners take over a little bit. I asked on my blog for them to send me what their best bird was of the migration. Not necessarily the most rare or the most unique, or just the most the one that touched them the most so far this migration. And we'll get to that in a little bit as well. And we'll hear from Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited. He's one of the sponsors of the show, as is we bring on Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. They're back as a advertiser with Bird Calls Radio, so we appreciate that. So thanks again for joining. And we should be hearing from Marty Dickinson pretty soon. She spent a couple weeks out in Ohio for the biggest week in American birding, so we're going to get and she's back from that. That's over now, so we'll see how that went for her. Maybe if there's time, we'll even take a little look back. I'll read from one of my favorite books. In fact, I think it is my favorite book. It's called Our Amazing Birds, and it was printed in 1951. We like to take a look back at what birding used to be like, 50, 60, 100 years ago, whatever. So we like to do that. So Our Amazing Birds, The Little-Known Facts About Their Private Lives by Robert S. Lemon, printed in 1951 by the American Garden Guild in Doubleday Company. So if we have time, I'll read about a warbler there as well. So looking forward to it. Thanks, everybody, for participating in the best bird of this migration period. So we'll be getting into that in a second. So that was the blog posting on Bird Calls Radio, which is the official website of Bird Calls Radio program. So check out birdcallsradio.com and find out what's coming up on the show, all the archives of all the past shows from over a year. So lots of good stuff there. And we're here with Bob Small. How you doing, Bob?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. Bob is the producer here and does a great job as always. And Bob just saw the big year for the first time.
Yeah.
Bob, so and you enjoyed it, right?
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, good. So you wouldn't necessarily call yourself a birder, but you enjoyed the movie anyway.
That's right.
All right. So good. Birding can transcend interests. It's a good book and a good movie. And we've had some of the big players from that book on Bird Calls Radio, so you could check out their archives on birdcallsradio.com. So Bob pushes buttons and makes us all sound good here on WGCH. So I'd like to thank Bob for that. Well, while we wait for Marty to give us a quick call, let's go into what some of our best birds were from the listeners. And I was pleased to hear from all over the country, as a matter of fact. So Jeannie from Port Charlotte, Florida, says her best bird of the migration was the rose-breasted grosbeak. Said they went through her area in a mini fallout. And she didn't know what that meant, but she does now that she experienced one. So a rose-breasted grosbeak from Florida. And Izzy from Seattle says she loves the western tanager. She says no matter where or when she sees it, she loves it. One showed up in her yard once, and she was so excited that she had to share it with everybody. So a western tanager from Seattle. I wish we could get more here on the East Coast. We come to you from Connecticut, but we have listeners from all over, and certainly welcome everybody to listen. Kim from Streetsboro, Ohio says a Kirtland's warbler was seen at McGee Marsh. So Marty will probably talk a little bit about that when she gets here. So Kim says both they saw a male and a female Kirtland's warbler, and they were both just gorgeous birds. And Terry, and I left out where she's from, but Terry wrote, a fleeting glance of a Baltimore Oriole, two great egrets, and sandhill cranes in flight. Those were her best birds. And Sally from Mentor, Ohio, says a Blackburnian warbler in her yard. The first sighting of this beautiful bird, and it was in her yard to make it even more special. And I mentioned that I would only say first names with this one, but I have to say the last name on this one too. Mary Birdsong from Erie, PA wrote, and yes, that is her real last name, she says. So Mary Birdsong appreciated most the cerulean warbler and a prothonotary warbler that she saw. And she also mentioned that a new friend of hers showed them to her, pointed them out, which made it even more special. And she writes that birding just isn't about looking at birds, and how true that is. So lots of experiences come from the birds. You're out there looking for the birds, obviously, but you never know what else will happen in your life when you're out there looking for the birds. So there you go. And thank you to everybody who participated and sent in their best sighting of this migration season. And so we certainly appreciate that. And if you missed it this week, what the heck, send it to me this week. I'll do it again next week or the week after. So, and you're always free to send any comments or sightings to me through birdcallsradio.com. Just click the contact me button. I'll be glad to hear from you. And I think we have Marty on the line now. So let's bring Marty on. She just spent a couple weeks in Ohio. And let's hear what she saw out there. Are you there, Marty?
Yes, I am, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you, Marty?
I'm well, thank you. I'm very well. It's a beautiful day here in Connecticut. Glad to be back.
That is good. And this is, of course, Marty Dickinson. She helps greatly with Bird Calls Radio. She's my partner here with the show, so I appreciate that. And I'm glad you're back, Marty, because things are hectic here without you.
I'm sure so, but I'm sure you were able to handle it just fine on your own.
We did okay, but I'm glad you're back. So tell me what you were out there for and what you saw. We had a little recap a couple weeks ago live on air, so you gave us, kind of start from the beginning and tell us what you were doing out there.
Okay, great. Can you hear me okay? Everything's clear on your end?
Yeah, everything's okay. Fine.
Great, terrific. Townie and I, my husband, for all those listeners who don't know, spent 16 days out in northwest Ohio. We went out, as we normally do on a yearly basis, although last year we didn't get there, to go out to see the warblers and to spend some downtime, primarily for vacation, but also to do a little work and to do some photographing. My husband's been photographing neotropical wood warblers for almost about 38 years. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so we went out into that area, which we've known for a while, and many birders also know about that area. Very, very rich habitat. We were able to see 23 warblers this year at McGee Marsh, mm-hmm. which is part of three different refuges out there. There's Ottawa Refuge, and there's McGee Marsh, and then there is Metzger Marsh. Sorry.
Okay.
Anyway, make a long story short, the biggest week has been going for, now this is their third year, and Executive Director Kim Kaufman, who's been on the show, oversees and started this venture 3 years ago. It has turned into this phenomenal, unbelievable festival out there. Townie and I go out prior to the festival, which this year started on the 4th, I think ended on the 12. And we like to go before to sort of watch the migration of, not sort of, to do yeah. and watch the migration of birds okay. come in. So we go from the beginning, we try to get into the middle of it, and then we try to see some of the ending birds that we hope to get, such as Connecticut warbler, which in fact we did.
Oh, good.
It was a really incredible time, great people to meet. I've met a lot of people in the birding industry that were out there this year, and also a vast group of new people that I've either been tweeting, Facebook, just been in contact with throughout mm-hmm. many years, that I finally got to do a face-to-face. So the bottom line was that we were able to take a look at these birds up close and personal. This boardwalk that is on McGee Marsh can tend to get not just around the biggest week, which has only been going for 3 years, but this is a place that many, many people go even without the biggest week there.
Mm-hmm.
It is not, it's really not a requisite that you have to join in on the biggest week. It's also a wonderful thing to do, but as Kim and many others will say, many people go out there just on their own to go bird watching in this fabulous area. Not only do you see warblers and songbirds such on McGee Marsh itself on the boardwalk, but there's also other locations just right nearby that you can see shorebirds and other various of birds also.
Okay. Hey, Mark, I got a question for you.
Sure.
So as I said, I was reading through some of the best sightings of migration through some listeners, and of course we appreciate them sending them in. But Kim from Streetsboro, Ohio writes that a Kirtland's warbler that she saw at McGee Marsh was her highlight. Did you see one out there? And what is the big deal about the Kirtland's warbler?
It's a pretty big deal. First of all, the Kirtland's usually nests, and you see more of them, which aren't that many, in Michigan. And many times on migration paths, once in a blue moon, you get to see a Kirtland's that would fly by. Now, because McGee Marsh and that general area is right on Lake Erie, that what happens is the birds come and either they stop prior to going across Lake Erie, and one of the places is McGee Marsh.
Okay.
And so they rest there, and then they continue going on north, or east, north. So the big deal is that few and far between get to see a Kirtland's, and they usually don't stick around for a long length of time. They can blow in, rest up, feed, and then continue on their passage. But in this case, and where County and I have seen 2 years ago a Kirtland's warbler that Ken Kaufman found for us, this year was just phenomenal. There were actually three Kirtland's warbler sightings.
Nice.
The first one was a male, the second one was a female, and I'm not sure what the third one was. That was sort of in between. County and I saw the female.
Okay.
And basically what happens is when somebody gets a notion of this, and it turns out, which was very cool, that there, I believe it was three Amish, now I'm not sure, Amish Mennonite slash, mm-hmm. discovered this Kirtland's, and it was on a dike that's not on the boardwalk, but a little bit further to the right of Lake Erie. It's nearby. It's right nearby, but it was actually on a dike stretch next to technically Crane Creek, which is part of McGee Marsh. And these three young children found the Kirtland's, then proceeded to tell somebody else.
Yeah, nice.
Then it got on to tell somebody else. Somebody verified it, and then it went out on Twitter.
Okay.
And with that, Biggest Week was hooked up to hashtag at Biggest Week,
mm-hmm.
and it went out, and a lot of people were hooked up to that.
Okay,
and one thing led to another, and it was basically like a stampede.
Yeah, I bet.
Out there, and we're talking hundreds of people saw this bird. Now, I can't give you an exact count mm-hmm. on that at this time. I certainly will update you at a later date when I get some more stats from out in Northwest. But hundreds and hundreds of people saw this. I think the first Kirtland's was seen there were several thousand people that saw it.
Oh, wow, great. Okay.
And it could have been the same also for this second one, too, but I can't give you the stats on it. But really, really exciting. Some great looks at it. Some people got some good pictures, but it's the kind of thing that once you get up to the bird, if you haven't gotten there really early on, mm-hmm. sometimes it can be difficult if you're carrying a large rig like county carries and several other things. So literally it's like sort of a crunch. And I will preface to say that it's a good crunch. It's just that people are so excited. There's hundreds of people standing there and everybody's going, where? And people are sort of pushing and leaning forward and going forward. But it's a very exciting time. And Kirkland's warbler is one of the biggest warblers. It's quite large. It's a handsome bird. Yellow in the front, has a lot of bluey black on the back of its head and down the back, and then a little bit of streaking in the front.
Okay.
We will be showing some highlights on my blog, Kimry.
At some
point in the near future, so we'll certainly keep you up to date on that.
Okay.
It was
good to get the color from the, kind of the feel for being there. We kind of have to move on. We got to get Joe on here. But I appreciate you being on. Okay, go ahead, Marty.
No problem. I just wanted to say that it's certainly worth going out there. You don't have to belong to or register for the biggest week for the following years. It's certainly something to put on your bucket list if you want to hit a migratory path. Towny thinks it's one of the richest songbird observation sites, as I agree, in North America. Mm-hmm. And I think it's certainly worthwhile to get out there if you get a chance. It's really exciting. It's really a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to see people. It's a great place to be. And that's about all the report I have.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Marty. And I'm sure we'll probably hear from you next week and week after. So we'll be talking to you soon.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. And we're going to get Joe Warren on in a second here. But let me tell you, who was that said they liked the Blackburnian warbler? That was Sally from Mentor, Ohio, liked the Blackburnian warbler. And I was lucky enough to see one in my tree in the backyard as well for the second year in a row. So let's hear what in his wonderful book from 1951, Our Amazing Birds. Let's hear what Robert Lemon says about the Blackburnian warbler. Now, in a second, we're going to hear lots about the cerulean warbler from Katie Fallon, but a little bit about the Blackburnian warbler. He says he wears the sun's glow on his breast. Wood warblers as a whole are widely noted for their bright and contrasting dress, covering literally all the colors of the rainbow. But of the 50-odd kinds which constitute the family, the Blackburnian is the most startlingly brilliant. When you see the May sun glinting on the flame-orange throat and upper breast of a male in full plumage, you can hardly believe that such a glowing, vital hue can be held in a few small feathers. The same gorgeous color is echoed on the forehead and cheeks, where it is accentuated by an intervening pattern of black, while the rest of the upper parts are strikingly black and white. Curiously enough, the spring markings of the female are almost identical with those of the male, although their colors are less vividly and stunningly displayed. So there's a little description of the beautiful Blackburnian warbler from Our Amazing Birds, the book, the 1951 book by Robert S. Lemon. And I believe we have a Joe Warren sighting. Are you there, Joe?
I am, Chris. How are you today?
Good. How are you? It's a beautiful day, isn't it?
It is an absolutely gorgeous day. We've had a beautiful weekend.
Okay. Now, before we get into birds, Joe, I want to wish somebody special a happy birthday that we missed by one day. So, your wonderful wife, Patty.
Yesterday was the boss's birthday, and she had a lovely day. She actually was here in the store for a good portion of the day, but we did have a lovely day. And that's very nice of you to mention it.
Okay. All right. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, a couple of things we want to talk about. It is spring. We have been talking in our recent shows about nesting season. I want to go back to something we said before, just to make sure everybody understands. Birds are now in the nest. They've laid eggs, or they're in the process of laying eggs, and the chicks are hatching. Every now and then, unfortunately, we find a circumstance where something falls out of the nest. Either an egg falls out of the nest or an actual chick falls out of the nest. Now, you have to be a little careful. There's an old wives' tale that says if you touch the nest or touch the chicks or the eggs, that your scent will be on it and the mother bird will never go back to the nest again. That is complete and utter nonsense. Birds have, for all intents and purposes, no sense of smell. And so you can touch the egg and put it back in the nest, and the mother bird will come right back and sit on it again.
Okay.
Now, what you want to look for is to make sure there's no cracks, that the egg isn't broken. If the egg is cracked, unfortunately, it will not survive, and it ought to just be discarded. The chicks, you want to be very careful that you take a good hard look at them. Our first reaction to a chick that's come out of a nest, leave it alone. Let nature take its course. In many cases, the female, the adult bird, the female or male, will come and feed the chick on the ground. But what you want to look for is, does this nestling have feathers? Is it fledged? Is it ready to be out on its own? If it has no feathers and it's still breathing, pick it up and put it back in the nest. The mother will come back and tend to it without any problem at all.
Okay.
But again, the first reaction is do nothing. Leave it alone. Let nature take care of it. If you have a question, if you think that there's something going on here and you're not quite sure what to do, call us. You can call here at the store, either the Darien store or the Bedford Hills store, and we'll put you in touch with a wildlife rehabber who can help you make a decision on what the right thing is to do. If the bird's been injured, we have people who will come out and pick up the injured bird and take them to a safe, secure place where they can nurse them back to health and then release them if it's possible. So, you know, use a little common sense here, but if you think that there's something that ought to be done and you're not sure what to do, give us a call. We'll help you out.
Okay. What's your number, Joe?
The number in Darien is 203-202-2669, and the number up in Bedford Hills is 914-241-0721.
All right. Now, I'm seeing a lot of babies already, Joe, so they'll be fledged soon. And what are the parents going to do for the rest of the spring and summer?
Fledging.
Are they just going to loaf for the rest of the summer, or what are they going to do?
It depends on the type of bird it is.
Okay.
For a lot of these birds, wrens, chickadees, tufted titmouse, as soon as the first brood fledges and the birds leave the nest, the birds will lay another set of eggs, and they'll have a second brood. In some birds, in the case of bluebirds, could have three broods during the summer. Now, what do they do when the eggs hatch and the chicks leave the nest? They fledge. For some birds, wrens, the chicks fledge, that's it, they're gone. Mom and dad are back on their own again. They'll lay in a second brood of eggs, and they'll get on with their lives. For some birds, like cardinals, the woodpeckers, the red-bellied woodpecker, the downy woodpecker, the parents will continue to look after the fledglings even after they've left the nest. They'll feed them. And if you watch really closely, it's a lot of fun to watch an adult bird try to teach a fledgling how to feed from a bird feeder. They'll come to the feeder and get seed and bring it to where the bird is and feed them, and then encourage the bird to go over to the feeder to get their own seed. And a lot of times the birds will go to the feeder, and they'll look, and they'll see the seed, and they'll get that funny look, you know, okay, I see the food, but I don't get food from here, I get food from Mom. And they'll go back, and they'll start the whole process all over again. What's really amazing to watch is that once they learn to feed themselves, they're gone. They don't need mom and dad anymore. They're off on their own. They've figured it out. Now I can take care of myself, and off they go. But it's fascinating to watch the birds in your backyard, to see this behavior, this parenting behavior, as they take care of the fledglings right after they first left the nest.
Okay, yet another reason to keep your feeders up in the spring.
It is a good reason to keep feeders up. The other thing, as I've told people in the past, while the parents may be feeding insects to the nestlings, the parents need their own energy source, and so the ability to come to your feeder and quickly get their own energy helps them a great deal in caring for the young.
Okay. All right, Joe. Well, tell us how to find you and what you're going to do for listeners of Bird Calls Radio.
Again, we have two stores, one in Darien across from the Noroten Heights Railroad Station and the other up in Bedford Hills across from the Splash Car Wash. And anybody who comes in and mentions this radio program gets a free 5-pound bag of bird seed.
All right. Well, thanks again, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Chris, as always, it's a pleasure. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
All right. Thanks. Tell Pat I said happy birthday again.
I will do that, and thanks again.
All right. All right. We're going to take a quick break here on Bird Calls Radio, and we're going to be right back with Katie Fallon, the author of Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird. I'm looking forward to speaking with this. Katie says her first word was bird, so we're going to ask her about that. We're going to hold her to that one. All right, so we'll be right back with Bird Calls here on 1490 WGCH.
Welcome to the wild. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no-waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
It is the ocean's most deadly predator. Sleek, powerful, the very name of it strikes fear into swimmers everywhere. It is... Want to know what one feels like?
Hurry into the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk for Touch a Shark. That's right, you can touch a real live shark in the aquarium's brand new Shark and Ray touch tank. Plus, you can take your picture in a shark cage and see baby sharks even before they're born. Touch a Shark completes the fantastic refurbishment at the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. Come see all that's new. 21 new exhibits, 27 new species, 300 new animals, and an all-new seal show too. For us, the Arctic is almost impossible to inhabit. But for the families that live here, it's home. Warner Brothers Pictures and IMAX invite you to experience a story of love, family, and survival in the harshest place on Earth. IMAX movie, To the Arctic, narrated by Meryl Streep with songs by Paul McCartney. Now playing in IMAX at the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak inviting you to check out birdcallsradio.com. It's the official internet home of the Bird Calls Radio program, heard right here on 1490 WGCH from 1 to 2 p.m. every Sunday. Bird Calls is your weekly look at the wonderful world of wild birds with regular features and expert guests. Birdcallsradio.com supports the show with bird blog postings, show archives, a Contact Me button where you can send in questions for the show, and a special page for potential advertisers to learn how to support Bird Calls Radio. So check out birdcallsradio.com and feel free to drop me a line.
Kimry Group is a boutique media service agency helping Fortune 500 corporations, nonprofits, and local businesses in all aspects of advertising, photography, and promotions. Kimry Photo includes assignments, stock images from 1925 to 2011, consulting, permissions, photo editing and research, as well as multimedia presentations. Kimry Media creates and executes activity for advertising, digital media, and sponsorship. To succeed and show how you can make a difference and get noticed, visit KimryGroup.com. That's K-Y-M-R-Y Group.com or contact Marty Welch Dickinson at 203-846-0359.
And welcome back to Bird Calls, everybody. This is Chris Bozak, your host. Remember, if you miss any shows, check out birdcallsradio.com for all the archives and lots more. And we have a special guest, Katie Fallon, the author of Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird, and looking forward to this interview. So hello, Katie, and welcome to Bird Calls Radio.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no problem. So to start off with, just give us a quick, just a quick rundown of what the book is about, when it came out, who published it, and kind of what it's all about.
Well, the book, Cerulean Blues, like you mentioned, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird, is basically me investigating the cerulean warbler. I'm not the only person who is obsessed with the cerulean warbler, it turns out.
Okay.
But, you know, as your listeners are mostly birders and bird watchers, I'm sure, so they know what it feels like to become kind of obsessed with a bird species,
mm-hmm.
especially one that's notoriously difficult to see.
Mm-hmm.
They stay up in the tree canopy. If you go out looking for ceruleans, you'll have a stiff neck at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
So back in 2001 or 2002, I listened to a presentation by a wildlife biologist from West Virginia University, and she spoke about ceruleans and their steep and steady decline. They've declined about 3% a year since 1966, which is when they started counting.
Mm-hmm.
So that means today there are about 80% fewer cerulean warblers than there were in the 60s.
Yeah, that's amazing to think about, isn't it?
Yes, it's very sad. So I heard this presentation and I thought, that's really too bad. Somebody should write a book about it. But I was in graduate school at the time. I didn't really think it would be me. But I, you know, stayed interested in the cerulean. And then in late 2006, I learned that ceruleans had been denied threatened status under the Endangered Species Act, despite their decline. And nobody had written a book yet about them.
Okay.
So I figured it should be me. So
okay.
I went and investigated them in their breeding grounds and then also where they spend the winter.
Okay, yeah. So you didn't just go to the library and read some field guides and write a book about it. You actually went and did your own research and traveled and...
Yes, I interviewed people who were doing the cerulean research here in West Virginia and in Tennessee, and also I went to Colombia in South America, where a lot of ceruleans spend the winter, interviewed people there. I got to be up close and personal with several ceruleans that were netted, and I got to go in the field a lot, and it was a lot of fun.
Okay, I saw one picture of you standing by a sign in, I believe it's in Colombia. Was that in Colombia, and where was that?
Yes, there. That was in the Cerulean Warbler Reserve.
Okay.
Which is near the town of San Vicente de Chucuri in northeastern Colombia, kind of on the way to Venezuela, but not quite that far.
Okay.
And it's a 550-acre reserve. It's a joint effort between a Colombian bird conservation group called Pro Aves, and they have about 14 reserves throughout Colombia, and they partnered with the American Bird Conservancy.
Okay.
And this reserve is, 500 acres of it is Colombian oak forest, and 50 acres is a coffee plantation that they are converting to shade-grown. Some of the coffee plots are shade-grown already, but some of them they're planting more trees around the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And shade-grown coffee, you probably know, is very important for migratory birds. Coffee in the tropics, the traditional way you grow it is in the shade of canopy trees.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, as the demand for coffee increases, the farmers want to grow coffee faster, so they will often cut down the trees, grow the coffee in the full sun. The coffee doesn't taste as good. It's not on the plant for as long. Coffee grown in the full sun requires more pesticides and more fertilizers, because if you leave the trees, you have nature's pesticides, you know, the birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So purchasing coffee that's certified bird-friendly or shade-grown is really important, not only to our neotropical migrants, but the tropical resident birds as well that eat insects.
Okay. Yeah, so that's one of the many small things that we as an individual can do to help all these birds that are, you know, are declining, is just to drink this certified shade-grown coffee.
Yes, it's a very easy consumer choice you can make.
Okay.
It's a little bit more expensive, but the coffee tastes better, and if you buy bird-friendly coffee from the tropics, you know, you are helping out our birds, the birds we consider ours anyway.
Yeah. So tell me what your goal was in writing this book and what the reaction has been since it came out.
Well, my goal, I haven't had a couple. I guess mostly I wanted to make people aware of the cerulean warbler and its decline. I mean, it seems like, you know, a tiny little warbler. If we lost them all, you know, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think we should care. I mean, it's a small piece of the puzzle. You know, they eat insects. They do their part to keep the ecosystems healthy where they live. So I wanted to raise awareness of their decline. I also wanted to raise awareness about some of the reasons for their decline. And in the breeding range, about 80% of ceruleans breed in central Appalachia between southwest Pennsylvania and east Tennessee. There are ceruleans elsewhere also. New York has some. I mean, even Minnesota, Michigan, Missouri,
mm-hmm.
Other places ceruleans are locally common, but really the vast majority are in central Appalachia. And here they tend to prefer to nest in large tracts of mature to old growth hardwood forests on ridges.
Mm-hmm.
And mountaintop removal coal mining is a fairly widespread mining practice in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky that destroys the habitat for cerulean warblers, and it also, you know, destroys the habitat for everything else too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not very good for humans who live close to these great big mines either.
Okay. Well, now what exactly is mountaintop mining? Is it just what it sounds like? They basically take off the top of a mountain, or what do they do?
Yep, it's basically what it sounds like.
Oh,
it really became more widespread in the 1970s, or I guess it really got started in the 1970s. Strip mining happened, you know, way before that, but what we know as mountaintop removal mining really got started in the 70s. And there were a lot of areas in Appalachia where there was still coal, but it was difficult to get to using traditional mining methods. Thin coal seams near the tops of mountains. So how it works, once the company identifies a mountain that has coal inside it, they clear off the trees, and then they drill holes into the side of the mountain, and they literally blow the top of the mountain off to expose the coal seams. And often the dirt and the rock and the non-coal material is pushed into the valley next to the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
They call those valley fills, and they often fill in streams.
Mm-hmm.
And then they scrape the coal from the thin coal seam. It sort of looks like a layer cake.
Okay.
And when they're finished, they are required by the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977 to reclaim the mine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult or impossible to put the mountain back.
Yeah, how would you do that?
You can't really.
Yeah.
So you can apply for a variance. The companies can apply for a variance, like an exemption from parts of the act, if they can say that their reclaimed mine can be used for something else if it's not returned to the correct height.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a shopping center or a golf course or,
oh my gosh,
you know, a prison or something like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, they call them wildlife habitat, and they will spray them with grass seed, and you will sort of have these plateaus covered with grass.
Yeah, just what birds like the cerulean warbler are trying to find, right?
Yeah, exactly. The problem with ceruleans, they, you know, are nest in the forest, in the hardwood forest on ridges. They don't mind some gaps in the tree canopy. If you think of an old growth forest, you would imagine, you know, a tree gets old and dies and falls down and creates the size of a gap that maybe a trail or a road or a small building would create. And ceruleans don't avoid that kind of gap. They tend to, they seem to sort of congregate around a small gap like that. But once you get a gap the size of a mine, and they're huge, huge mines, the scale is very, very big, the ceruleans that gap is too big for them.
Okay.
And they will avoid a hard edge, the hard edge that's created between the forest and the mine site, and they will move in from that edge. So in addition to removing their breeding habitat outright, you degrade the habitat along the edge as well for ceruleans.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like they have a lot of major obstacles along their whole, basically their whole lives as they travel. So take us, let's pretend we're a cerulean warbler and it's January and we're on our winter grounds. What are, you know, kind of reiterate and tell us what kind of challenges you have, and then move us as we go into migration northward. Tell us all the different challenges that they face.
Okay, sure. Well, January, they're probably hanging out in the tropics.
Okay.
Where we all would like to be.
Yeah, sounds nice.
Yes, and they spend the winter in the northern Andes, sort of middle elevations of the northern Andes. So Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, a little bit of Bolivia. And where they're spending the winter on those Andean slopes overlaps with the coffee-producing regions as well, like I mentioned before. They tend to be in mixed species flocks in the wintertime, so they don't really seem to have territories. They're not breeding. So they might be in flocks with other neotropical migrants and some tropical residents as well, foraging for insects in the forests on the slopes of the mountains, and also in the trees that are providing shade for, that are left to provide shade for coffee plants.
Mm-hmm.
Trees like tropical ficus, tropical oak. They look sort of like our deciduous trees look.
Okay.
Right. So they spend the time down there in the tropics, you know, eating the insects. Ceruleans, they think they may occasionally get nectar also when they're down there, but mostly insects. And then come springtime, they're not one of the first migrants back. I mean, we have migrants coming back, you know, very early in the spring. Ceruleans don't usually make it back to the breeding grounds until mid-April would be some early ones, and then more of them come back, you know, into early May. So they take off from the northern Andes. Some of them stop over in Central America on their way,
mm-hmm.
The Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, Honduras, Belize, maybe Costa Rica and Panama. Some of them will stop and kind of replenish their food stores on the way.
Okay.
In that region, there are some of the same issues with coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Coffee is grown throughout Central America as well, so if there aren't canopy trees, the ceruleans and other migratory bird species might not have a place to stop over.
Okay, geez.
There's also a lot of coastal development in those regions for resorts and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then the ceruleans, well, they probably take off from the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. It's very difficult to do this research during migration because you only have about 2 weeks to figure out.
Yeah.
Because they're all flying, you know, they're flying through. You don't really, you know, you don't have like a whole season. You only have 2 weeks.
Yeah, that must be stressful as a researcher because, you know, if you miss a little window, you got to wait a whole other year until you could try again.
Yes, and that's the one part of the book I didn't get to go to the stopover habitat because that two weeks in the spring and 2 weeks in the fall when they're migrating always managed to fall the beginning of a semester or at the end of a semester.
Okay.
and I teach writing, and I just could never get there. So most biologists think they take off from Central America and fly across the Gulf of Mexico, which is an amazing thing that any birds make it at all.
Yeah, really.
And they probably hit the continent of North America somewhere around the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, kind of in that Mississippi Delta area.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, they continue north and disperse to where they breed. So usually the earliest I hear ceruleans in West Virginia is, you know, somewhere around April 20th, April 25th, something like that is usually when I get my first one.
Okay. All right. We are going to take just a really quick break.
Sure.
We have lots more to talk about, but we're going to take a quick break. And this is Katie Fallon, the author of Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird. I want to come back and talk more about the book and about some other things. So we'll be right back here on Bird Calls at 1490 WGC8.
Welcome to the Wild. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, where you can turn your backyard into an unlimited oasis of natural harmony. With birdhouses, feeders, and baths, no-waste seed blends, and a great selection of garden and gift items, Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop is any nature lover's paradise. Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, in Bedford Hills, New York, and now in Darien, Connecticut.
It is the ocean's most deadly predator, sleek, powerful. The very name of it strikes fear into swimmers everywhere. It is... Want to know what one feels like?
Hurry into the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk for Touch a Shark. That's right, you can touch a real live shark in the aquarium's brand new Shark and Ray Touch Tank. Plus, you can take your picture in a shark cage and see baby sharks even before they're born. Touch a Shark completes the fantastic refurbishment at the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. Come see all that's new. 21 new exhibits, 27 new species, 300 new animals, and an all-new seal show, too. For us, the Arctic is almost impossible to inhabit. But for the families that live here, it's home. Warner Brothers Pictures and IMAX invite you to experience a story of love, family, and survival in the harshest place on Earth. IMAX movie, To the Arctic, narrated by Meryl Streep with songs by Paul McCartney. Now playing in IMAX at the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk.
Kimry Group is a boutique media service agency helping Fortune 500 corporations, nonprofits, and local businesses in all aspects of advertising, photography, and promotions. Kimry Photo includes assignments, stock images from 1925 to 2011, consulting, permissions, photo editing, and research, as well as multimedia presentations. Kimry Media creates and executes activity for advertising, digital media, and sponsorship. To succeed and show how you can make a difference and get noticed, visit KimryGroup.com. That's K-Y-M-R-Y Group.com or contact Marty Welch Dickinson at 203-846-0359.
Hi, this is Chris Bozak inviting you to check out BirdCallsRadio.com. It's the official internet home of the Bird Calls Radio program, heard right here on 1490 WGCH from 1 to 2 p.m. every Sunday. Bird Calls is your weekly look at the wonderful world of wild birds with regular features and expert guests. BirdCallsRadio.com supports the show with bird blog postings, show archives, a Contact Me button where you can send in questions for the show, and a special page for potential advertisers to learn how to support Bird Calls Radio. So check out BirdCallsRadio.com and feel free to drop me a line.
Well, I like birds.
And welcome back to Bird Calls, everybody. This is Chris Bozak, your host, and we're here with Katie Fallon, the author of Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird from Ruka Press. Am I pronouncing Ruka correctly, Katie?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
Ruka Press. Okay. All right. So it's great stuff so far, and so we kind of see the challenges that they face pretty much throughout their whole lives, north to south, and also south to north. What do you think needs to happen for the numbers to start climbing again for the cerulean warbler?
Well, protecting the habitat where they breed is really important. One of the biologists I talked to said, you know, ceruleans are losing habitat everywhere, but the only place where you can create more ceruleans is in the breeding habitat during the breeding season. And if we keep letting the habitat degrade here, we're not going to produce as many to offset the ones that don't make it back after spending the winter in the tropics. So one thing people can do to help the cerulean would be to, you know, speak out against mountaintop removal coal mining, which can be tough to do sometimes in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other ways to get coal if we have to get it. Also, buying bird-friendly, certified bird-friendly coffee is really important for protecting their wintering habitat and their stopover habitat. And the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center has a very strict certification process. So mm-hmm. if you're not sure which certification is the best, it's brown and green. It says Bird Friendly at the top and Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center at the bottom, and you can find out what their requirements are for their shade grown certification, and they're very strict.
Okay. All right, well, now that we've piqued everybody's interest on the book, tell us ways that people can find it and get it.
Ah, hopefully everywhere. Everywhere fine books are sold. it's available on Amazon, and it's also available through Ruka Press's website, just Ruka, R-U-K-A, press.com. I know my local, like Barnes & Noble, has it, but I'm not sure if they do everywhere.
Okay. But, all right. So certainly plenty of ways to get it. And you're doing a book signing tonight, right? Now, maybe our Connecticut listeners won't be heading down, wouldn't have time to head down, but if somebody in West Virginia area is listening, tell us about what you're doing tonight.
Yes. Tonight I'm having a book signing. It's at a conference, actually, for the USDA at a hotel here in Morgantown. I have a couple book signings and book presentations coming up. If people are interested in seeing where I will be doing these presentations, if you go to katiefallon.com, there's a link to my events. And I'm doing a few more this summer, and then I have to take a short break to have a baby.
Okay, good. That's a good excuse to have a break.
Yes. Yep, and then in the fall I'll be starting up again doing some more presentations. And okay. If any of your listeners are in the West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania area, that's where most of my presentations have been.
Okay, terrific. So tell us a little bit about what you discovered by writing the book and in the research of the book about kind of the connection between the cerulean warbler and any vanishing bird, for that matter, and we as humans.
Well, I found that often what's good for the birds is also good for people. And what hurts the birds, what damages their habitat also damages our habitat. Human health and ecosystem health and wildlife health are linked. And when you try to unlink them, it doesn't work. I mean, every mountaintop removal coal mining, for example, West Virginia University has done studies of people living near these mines, and the rates of COPD and kidney disease and certain cancers are much higher than people not living near the mines. And groundwater also is contaminated by a lot of mining. And in the tropics, cutting down all the trees on the side of a mountain slope to plant coffee might make the coffee farmers more money faster, but it also means that the farmers have to handle more fertilizers, more pesticides, and some of their pesticide restrictions down there are not as strict as ours are up here. And also erosion can be a problem in the tropics if you cut down all the trees on the side of a mountain. Mm-hmm. It rains there a lot.
Yeah.
And erosion is also a problem in Appalachia. A lot of when they do mining reclamation, a lot of the focus is on compacting the soil to prevent erosion, which sometimes works, but it also means that, compacted soil, you can't really grow trees in it. If you ever have a garden, you turn up the soil. That's the first thing you do, probably. So there are problems for people in both regions also, and I think this little bird is really a link between people in the Appalachian Mountains and in the Andes Mountains.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it seems like the human footprint just keeps getting bigger and bigger. When you think that we would know better by now.
Yes, you would think so.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a couple minutes left, so I need not real short answers, but relatively short answers to these ones, because I really want to get to these topics. So you have a new book coming out. That's a small segue from a cerulean warbler to vultures, right?
Yes, I'm working on the vulture book right now. It's still in process, but it will be about vultures. So I'm going from small, cute, and declining to large, not as cute, maybe, and probably increasing.
Okay, all right. But as you've discovered already, it's maybe not vultures maybe not be increasing throughout the whole world, maybe just where we are.
They are not, yes. Yeah, we are turkey vultures and black vultures, especially black vultures seem to be increasing a little bit, but worldwide vultures aren't doing well everywhere, especially in India, Pakistan. Their vulture populations have crashed recently. Also, Africa has some trouble with their vultures. And when you lose vultures, when you lose these big birds that eat a lot of carrion, that can create a public health crisis.
Okay, interesting. Well,
What's happening in India?
Yeah, so we look forward to seeing that book as well. Tell us briefly about the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia.
Yes. This is a new organization that a group of us have gotten started here near Morgantown. We've got our federal rehabilitation licenses for migratory birds, so we're rehabbing injured and orphaned birds of all species. We are also doing some public education, and we have some citizen science-based research projects that we're getting started. So it's kind of, we did a crazy thing and, you know, tried to start this nonprofit, but it's going very well so far.
Okay. All right. And I'm going to throw, we have only about 45 seconds, so a big topic that I'm going to throw at you to wrap up in 45 seconds. So how important is it for you as a writer to communicate what the scientists are discovering?
It's very important. I feel like there's a lot of awesome science out there, and it's sometimes difficult for the researchers to communicate their results, especially with emotion. So I feel like my job is to translate some of this excellent research folks are doing to the rest of the public.
Okay. All right. Well, Katie, thank you so much for being on Bird Calls Radio, and best of luck with Cerulean Blues and your next book and your baby forthcoming. So good luck with everything, and thanks for being on.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris, for having me. This is great.
All right. Thanks, Katie. And that's about it for Bird Calls Radio. That was Katie Fallon, the author of Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird. I want to thank my sponsors, Wild Birds Unlimited and Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. Also thank Marty Dickinson for her update on the biggest week in American birding, Joe Warren from Wild Birds Unlimited, and Bob for pushing the buttons and making us sound good. And we'll see you next week. Check out birdcallsradio.com for archives and for comments. Send me comments and your best sightings. And we'll see you next week here on 1490 WGCH.